Welcome to episode 10 of Mindful Decontamination for First Responders. We have a special guest with us today, Ulf Sandstrom, and Kathy is with us, of course. And
hello.
And I want to start off with just, Ulf, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us who you are so that the listeners can understand who we're talking to today.
Okay. Well, thanks. And thanks for pronouncing my name perfectly. So, well, I'm a Havening colleague in a way, but I'm also a Tapping colleague. I've been working with emotional first aid with vulnerable populations, if you want to call it that, vulnerable populations since 2010. So it's 12 years now. And I've been working with my colleague, Gunil Hamna. We have a nonprofit, which is called the Peaceful Heart Network. So we've been active in up to 30 countries using emotional first aid to ease suffering and prevent violence, because that's what happens when people can't control their inner peace. So we've been working with survivors, and we've been working with first responders. We've been working with perpetrators. We've been working with victims. And we've done some studies. We've had some amazing results. And most of all, we follow people all the time. So the people that we treated 12 years ago, we're still in touch with them. And so we know long-term results and what it means. And we've also been working in the refugee camp Moria in Lesbos a couple of years.
Lots. You do lots. You've been doing lots. I met Ulf on, through Havening. And so I think we've got the same, I don't know, we've got the same ideas about everything. I think when we started talking about, especially first responder stuff, that's how we met. And I know, we're going to have you teach two techniques. But first, I just want to say, let's shoot the shit, because we're in the U.S. over here. And, you know, we had Daniel Sundahl on. He's in Canada. You know, we're all over the world. And the problems are still remain the same with first responders and emergency services personnel. Don't you agree?
We were talking about that before we started recording, that there are certain things that are very specific for first responders that are different from other people. And it's also very specific for people who work in humanitarian aid, because they're facing kind of similar issues, but also different. And some of them are first responders working with humanitarian aid and action. So it's double whammy there. Yeah. And it's very specific. I mean, we realized that working with the Orlando Sheriff's Office, we did a training with where we had the emergency phone operators in the same room as the police and the first responders. And it was amazing that they had, and the firemen, and they had never really talked about how different their situations were.
I love that, because I think that's something we, in our Ashes to Art program, we go ahead and we make sure that the family members are involved. And we've had classes that we have fire, paramedic, dispatcher, sheriff, and their spouses and their kids all in the same room. And I think that's incredibly important, because it's not just the first responders, it's the families that are out there, you know, not knowing what to do and getting in the way or getting out of the way or whatever they need to do and learning the tools. So, and also I think there's that battle of first responders wanting to be at home. I don't want to take care of myself because I've got to be at home. I haven't been at home. I want to spend time with family. So like offering things to do with the entire family. But I feel like there is such a disconnect, even like with dispatchers in a Northern Virginia fire department. They reached out and called me and said, our dispatchers really need some help. And I was like, well, where's behavioral health? Why are you calling me? Like, you got a behavioral health department. Where are they? What's going on? It's like dispatchers are off. You know, they can't even control anything. They can control the little bit, and they don't have the images, and then their minds can keep going because they can't even say, you know, they have no idea what's going on. And then the next call's coming, so they can't follow up. And it's like, what, you know, of course you need help, but why are they not a part of the team?
I would argue they need more, they experience more stress because they have very little ability to interact.
And so helpless. Yeah.
So I agree. That was the exact same experience that we had when we were talking to, we were interviewing. They said, so they hear when people, well, it's just happened. People are still crying. There's still noise in the background. There's still things going on. And it's like, they get to see the start of every horror movie they could imagine, but they never get to see the ending. So they have no idea if anything was ever solved anywhere.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Crazy. So I love that you did that. And I think we need more of that.
Yeah.
Kathy and I always talk about the resistance that public safety has against mental health. But I feel like, I was thinking this morning, it's not public safety maybe have a lot of resistance, but it's world culture we need to change. Like, look what happened to Simone Biles when she said, I don't think I want to do gymnastics in the Olympics because I don't feel like I'm mentally able to do that right now. And she got vilified for taking care of herself.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think part of it is in the language, you know, it's the whole idea that post-traumatic stress is a disorder and that it's chronic kind of screws things up, because if you're a police or you're a soldier, a fireman, you're trained to obey orders, not to disorder. And having a disorder is like getting a stamp in your forehead saying you failed. And it's not a failure. It's part of the job. So we usually reframe it and say that the acronym actually stands for a perpetuating post-traumatic defense function.
Well, and we've talked about this. I mean, PTSD and any sort of traumatic stress is normal. It would be a normal reaction to an abnormal circumstance. So, I mean, that's where it's like the irony really gets to me, that it's like, no, that's what your mind and body are supposed to do. They're supposed to shut down. They're supposed so that your amygdala is going to be taking care of everything so that you can go and, do what you need to do, but done over and over and over without self-regulation, so it's like, that's a normal reaction as far as I'm concerned for abnormal circumstances. Cause what's normal really,
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and also, I don't know if that's the same in the States, but here in Sweden, we have been more in touch with police. And if you compare like firemen and first responders, and police, the police have a very specific situation, because a fireman can be a hero either way, but a police is not always a hero, not in everybody's eyes, especially, you come to a domestic call, house call, and there's somebody's down on the ground. It could be the wife, and there's the person is rambling around with a baseball bat. You disarm him. And then all of a sudden comes a 12-year-old trying to save his father. And it all gets extremely messy very fast. And then you come home and you're actually, at least in Sweden, you're not allowed to talk to your spouse about it unless your spouse is also in the force, which means that you have to carry this in your head and try to sit and have dinner with your own 12-year-old. How was work, dad or mom? Mm-mm. That's a weird situation.
So how do you think things are going in Sweden as far as like the first responder self-care? And again, we're going to say we choose to call it mindful decontamination over self-care, because asking these guys to practice self-care, that's based on civilians. It's not based on perpetual traumatic stress.
I like that. So yeah. Well, we talk about creating resilience for daily pressure. Part of the job is trauma. So let's know how to deal trauma. I mean, if you're working as a doctor in an area with Ebola, you have a safety suit on so you don't get contaminated. It's the same thing with emotional issues. It's invisible. It contaminates. You need to know how to handle it. And you need to know the signs that you might be contaminated. So we call it clean debrief. So after a traumatic incident, instead of talking about it, because we all know that just normal debrief can be re-traumatizing. But if you do debrief with havening, for example, self-havening and just a short after-action review, what did we learn and how can we use that next time? And everybody speaks. Then if everybody is doing that, you're actually cleaning it up and getting rid of it and maintaining the actual experience and knowledge. And that's fine. But everybody doesn't do that.
Yeah. So how do we get everybody to do it? Do you guys, because I think we spoke before, like it, this is where, and I'm going to, my mission right now, I think I'm becoming more of an advocate role, which is, how do we expect our fire services and our first responders, everything's coming from the top. You're ordered to do this and you got to follow that protocol. But then with mental health, they're like, you know what? Why don't you guys figure it out yourself? And it's like, okay. So all the guys who have gone up the ranks and they haven't done their work, then they've got to be men and women who haven't done their work. Then they're in charge of creating something for these men and women that they know nothing about and that has been resistant and untouched. Yet we're going to go to do this. And the fact of the matter is, it needs to come from the top. It needs to, maybe not like in a specific format, but it needs to be some sort of, this is what we need to address. And let's figure that out, because there needs to be protocol and a protocol driven profession. If not, it's just, look, we're going to be here 10 years from now if it doesn't come from the top. Someone will adopt someone else's program, and then a new chief will come in and he'll dismantle it and create something else and put his name on it and blah, 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 blah.
So if you look at Christine Holthaus, who is a doctor in Costa Rica, she knows both tapping and, I mean, mainly tapping in her case. And she introduced it to her nurses, not to her colleague doctors. And they started using it to just help people calm down in the different wards. And what happened was that the doctors all of a sudden, you know, just burst in and said, what the heck is going on here? Why medication is going down and people are becoming well? Have we changed something? And that way they introduced it as a grassroots movement, which actually opened up the door by proving the proof of the pudding was in the eating, right? So I think that's a way. In the military, I think it's easier because it's more matter of fact, because in military, it's like, if it works, we'll do it. If it doesn't, we'll throw it out, because it's, you know, it's very matter of fact, pragmatic, life or death. But when it comes to somebody introducing it, I think I look a lot at civil rights movements because that's how change happens. Sometimes it's this one individual who's brave and just does it. So I would say emotional rights movement. That's what we need.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Hardcore.
I like it.
But I do believe, well, first of all, I do believe this is a life or death. You know, I just forwarded something to Craig. I don't know where was it? Where was that person based? The cop that committed suicide and then his wife shortly did it afterwards.
That was Florida.
I mean, and with a little baby, leaving a little baby, like it is
what
life.
What profession was it?
Law enforcement.
Yeah.
It is life or death. So I think we've got people around that are making changes, and we do need the studies. This is the other thing, is I'm like, there are all these studies on all these different procedures and techniques that work, but it has to be just for firefighters. I'm like, okay, I get it. That's their, you know, I get that part, but for goodness sakes, like, why is it taking so long for anyone to even try this? Because all the civilians are using it. Say it's EMDR, say it's, you know, Havening's got, some science behind it. Why not try this?
Tapping has loads and loads and loads. And the rewind technique of NLP has been used for veterans of wars we've even forgotten now. So, I mean, it's fully possible to do. And the whole idea, the whole notion that we should have like scientific trial evidence for using an intervention to make people feel good, that isn't even a working field, because you cannot, people are not lab rats. We don't heal in petri dishes. We need to be in reality and we need to try this stuff, and it doesn't cost anything. And if we do it and it works, we have the data. So, I mean, any fire department or, you know, middle boss or even somebody just on the station who cares should be able to say, you know what, we're going to do this. We're gonna just do it every freaking day, 5 minutes. And before we go back from an incident, before we go into the station, we're gonna do a blowout and we're gonna do our debrief with this tapping thing, whatever that is. And we're gonna see what happens in 3 weeks. And when somebody does that, somebody else is gonna go, you know what they're doing over at the other station? It sounds crazy, but you know, it's Mick. And he usually, you know, he only tries things that work. Yeah, and I heard that Jane was doing it too. And all of a sudden, that's how it spreads. That's what I see.
And that's what we need to encourage. We need to empower our listeners to do this, to take the leap and do this, and be leaders among your peers.
So yep. Speaking of tapping and Havening and the blowout. So we've introduced Havening a little bit in earlier sessions, but do you want to, are you interested in introducing the blowout technique? I think it's fascinating. Do you want to talk about that and talk about?
Absolutely. So the interesting thing is, what we do know today that we didn't know 10 years ago with the fMRI scan is that there is a neurobiology to trauma. It's simple. It's chemistry. We're electrochemical organs. And if you believe you're about to die, you're going to feel like you're about to die. It's that simple. So you're a hypnotist and I work with hypnosis. So you have this inner hypnotist. If it goes, it'll be okay. I'm good. I'm fine. It's going to be all right. I'm going to fix this. I've done this before. I can do this. If that's your inner voice, you're probably not going to break out in cold sweat and make mistakes. But if your inner voice is going,
holy shit,
hope nobody notices. I feel so bad today. I'm not going to tell anybody I had that quarrel with my wife. They can tell. If that's what you're saying in your head, you know, your mind isn't 100% doing what you should be doing. We call it clouding your competence with fear. You're in a toxic tunnel, a toxic trance, talking yourself out of your capabilities. Now, here's the interesting thing. What's the alternative? What people do? Well, in these professions, it's very special. You need to trust your colleagues. You need to know what you're doing. You need to be tip top in the zone. It's like being an elite athlete. It's comparable in every single way because you're at the peak of your ability and you have to have lightning fast reactions. And it is even life and death, which isn't for the athletes all the time. So here's the thing. Most keep quiet about it, and they don't want, in Sweden at least, some of them don't want to go see somebody, because if they see somebody, it means there's an economical trail of seeking help for something that might get you kicked out of your job, and you don't want that. Yeah. So you're quiet about it, which makes you a danger. And then finally, when you do break, you break badly, and then you're sent to a psychiatrist that never met a fireman or a law enforcement officer or a first responder ever. So they start by asking you to sit down and breathe and think of a raisin and, you know, see if you can watch your thoughts just move in front of you like a train. And now there's science proving that mindfulness is wonderful unless you have flashbacks, because then you're actually letting the flashbacks in there.
Yeah.
So
I haven't met one responder who doesn't have flashbacks. Have you, Craig?
No,
I haven't met one.
Like I have visions that just pop in.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we all do. And we're supposed to. That's how we stay alive. That's evolution. We are supposed to be reminded of stuff that could kill us and hurt us. And the more we've seen, the more pops in.
I like what you said about the voice in your head. That made me think of a phrase. The boss is in your head. Be a good boss.
Like, exactly.
I like that.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, thing is this also, if you want to have some, you know, practical advice for everybody out there. So it's very simple. When you hypnotize somebody, what you do is you narrow their reality into a reality tunnel that's smaller. Anybody in pain or a fear has a very narrow reality tunnel and only focuses on anything that will get them away from what they fear or feel pain of. So trance is like a zoom lens that zooms in really close, and pain is a trance, fear is a trance, anxiety is a trance. That's why it's so dangerous to be in fear, because you're not accessing your whole self, right? And that's why people take stuff literally. So
there's an interesting, can I just say one thing as you're saying absolutely. That? Because that's the first time I've heard you say that, but or that I've put it together. There's a grounding tool that's kind of deals with tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. And so the way that you're saying that is like the tunnel vision that occurs sometimes with anxiety, you're supposed to focus on your peripheral.
Exactly.
So that it goes outwards. So that's right there. Anybody who's interested, that's a grounding tool. And you just explained why.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. If you go into peripheral vision, you are no longer in tunnel vision.
In tunnel vision.
It's that simple. You just reverse the process. So here's the deal. Whenever that voice in your head describes something, instructs you to do something, that paints a painting you don't like, change the wording. Now, that's a classical reframe if you go into NLP or whatever kind of psychological, you know, talk stuff. But it's really simple. Instead of saying, I don't want my foot stuck in the fire under that log, that you're going to have an image of a foot stuck in a fire under a log. You know, it's very simple. I don't want to die. I don't want to lose all my blood. All you're seeing is what you don't want. That's like going to the supermarket with a long list saying, don't get peanut butter, don't get Coke, don't get bread, don't get eggs. Right?
And you got all the other choices.
That's all I get.
So say stuff you want to see when it creates an image in your head. I want to maintain my balance. I want to stay safe. I want to see my kids tonight. I want to get home. I want to be fine, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the number one. And the number two rule of self-hypnosis, you know, if you want to be kind to yourself, is to look for process rather than absolutes. Nominalization is dangerous. I just want to be at peace. There's no such thing. Not if you have kids or dogs or live a life with people. So I want to be more peaceful. That's attainable. You can always be more peaceful. To be at peace, impossible. I just want to be happy, impossible. I want to be happier, possible, every breath. So look for process and look for nice images and you'll be fine.
That is great. That's a good start. So I want to hear about, Kathy told me that there's things happening in firehouses in Sweden and around Europe that you're a part of before and after they go on calls. What is happening? Is this blowout technique we're about to talk about, right? You're doing, are firefighters doing this in Europe?
Well, I wouldn't talk for Europe. I would talk for the stations and the firemen I've spoken to, and they will be doing it. Also, a lot of sport teams are doing it, and it's been filmed on television as well. I mind trained a football team all the way up to the All-Swedish, which is the highest Swedish league. And I asked them afterwards, how much difference did the mind-focused training tools do for you? They said, 1.5 to 2 points, which is what got them over the line and put them in the All-Swedish. Fine. Which one of the techniques or trainings of everything we did was the most useful for you? And so they said it was the blowout technique. It made like the biggest. So if you want the, you know, 20-80 rule of what makes the biggest difference, it's the blowout technique. So the way we applied it for fire stations is before you go on a call, or a mission, or whatever you call it. I don't know. What do you call it in the States?
We call it an incident, a call.
Okay. Before you go on a call or go on an incident, if there's time to do it before you go, it will help you to rebalance your adrenaline and carbon dioxide and oxygen system so that you don't get the tremble of excitement of having excess adrenaline and you don't get the brain fog of having slightly imbalanced between carbon dioxide and oxygen. So it takes 2 seconds to do. And it just allows you to get a reset so that you're in the zone with your maximum capacity rather than being slightly on the other side of the zone where you're not really at your best.
And to be clear, they can still function. It's just physiologically regulating.
Fine-tuning the system, you know, tuning the carburetor so that you're getting maximum, you know, fuel and air.
And where does it come from and who figured this out? Like what it... Tell us the story behind
it. I wish I could give a brilliant answer to that. Donna Eden has something called blowout, which is slightly different because it ends in a calmer thing. We use something we call adrenaline blowout. I don't remember where we got it, but we have talked to people in the armed forces, and we know that the Israeli armed forces, they use it before and after any mission that they're doing. That's at least from people who have been there. So I don't know if the whole troop, everybody does it or just those people we talked to, but they described it as to get rid of that excess adrenaline, but also after a mission to get rid of the shaky of GI survived, you know, and also there's this survivor guilt and there's this, you know, why didn't I get the one that got away and all that stuff that's going on, plus the images. So what you do is you put your arms in the air, you clench your fists, you breathe in, and then you pull down and breathe out fast, kind of karate-ish, okay? And you do that 3 times. And when you do that, what you're doing is you're blowing out all the carbon dioxide that might be resting nested in your belly, which is you're resetting your balance of oxygen and carbon dioxide, and you're using your excess adrenaline that makes you a little bit trembly. So that instead of, you know, it's like you just press the gas pedal of the car to clear the carburetor. That's what you're doing. And sometimes when people have domestic arguments, like, or they have an argument, somebody gets really revved up, they will slam their fist into the kitchen door or something. That's the same kind of mechanism. It's not always aggression directed somewhere. It's frustration and adrenaline that needs to get out.
Sometimes they're calmer. They're calmer after that happens.
Yeah. And so what happens is when you do this together, you get a ritual where actually people sync up and do it at the same time. So instead of everybody getting off the truck and going into the station, bringing with that contaminated energy of some feeling really frustrated and some are fine, like all, everybody's different, right? But if you get off the truck and you don't discuss and just go, shoo, 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 and then, you know, you walk into the station, you've actually made a ritual to cleanse yourself, but you've also made it neurobiologically.
I love that. Now, do you process if Is that all you need? Or do you need to process things if it's a tougher call, or how else?
I would definitely do a clean debrief. I mean, I'm a fan of AAR, after action review. Yeah. I'm trained by the contingency services here, and I've done it on large. We did this Barnes rescue, which was first responders, blue light, and police and firemen and military from like four different countries collaborating on a joint accident scenario. And after each collaboration, everybody wears different helmets, different uniforms, everything means different stuff. So it's hard to collaborate, you know, between all these different languages and cultures and rules. So after each incident, what you do is you evaluate what happened. And instead of going, you know, who did what and why and what went wrong, the absolutely shortest version of after action review is, what did we learn? Not who did what. What did we all learn from this? And how can we use that next time?
Positive picture. So
that's the minimum version. But it takes away the focus of whom to blame, whom to shame, what happened, you know, who do we mourn? It's just, what did we learn? Mm-hmm. We learned that a fire in an electric car is really different from a fire in a diesel car.
Yeah.
Especially when you try to put it out.
With water.
With water.
I would do that.
That's good. So what I'm imagining is the tones go off, beep, you know, engine 433, house fire, whatever. Yep. Address, person. Yep. Trapped, second floor.
Yep. Yep.
Crew stands up and they blow it out together.
Yeah.
Hands up, down.
Yeah.
That's go to it. The truck, get dressed, go. Yep.
Go.
And then that's, you can almost do it while you're walking to the truck. I mean, together.
Yeah, you could.
You could. Yeah.
I mean, there's, I don't know how much time there is, you know.
I'm just thinking about barriers. People are going to say, I ain't got time to do that. I got to go to an emergency. You said someone's trapped on the second floor.
Right. Exactly. So I would say, you know, it might not be possible before, but if it's possible, it's always possible after. And it's even more important after. Now, when it came to the sports team, for example, the goalkeeper, Frank Pedersen, you could see him on television when it was the finals. He would be standing there and somebody would be running up to him. Stress levels would be going up. He would just do a quick shoo, and then he would be there. And you know, his track record was immaculate. So he would just use it to regulate on the spot. And
I think it's good. The other incident could be the beginning of the shift. So we have what's called a lineup in the morning. So we all get around. We say what we're going to do for the day. All right, you're going to do this. Yep. We're going to do that. Let's look at this. We got this drill. We got that. All right, everybody, let's blow it out. And then you can do it three times and then go.
And then you walk away. I mean, you do it and then you walk away and
start doing stuff. It's like the last thing you do and you go, all right, everybody ready to break? Blow it out. Shoom, shoom, shoom. And then everybody goes.
I'll see if I can get the clip for you. The television, the team I coached, I was part of coaching, did kind of a dream thing. It was called the Magical Journey because from the beginning it was a refugee project. They weren't even an official team, but they climbed so fast and so high, they made it all the way to the All-Swedish. So television made a documentary and they were lots of refugees from different countries. And one of them, a really colorful guy, beautiful captain of the team, he would be doing this in the locker room just before they run out. And he would do it, you know, mid-play, mid-game, just before they run out and afterwards as well. So regardless if they won or lost, it would always reset the team and get them all back to this point where they're a team and they're reminded that they're a team and that they're together. You know, it's the musketeer, one for all.
The collective quality and the ritual quality. Yeah. I really like. Really,
I guess
like that.
Backing into a fire station, an ambulance or a squad or a truck or whatever it is. And before they get out of the vehicle, they're like, okay, let's blow it out.
Yep.
And then we're going to do an after action report. We're going to do a cleansing debrief. And then we're going to move on. So then they could do that together. Yep. After they back up, before they get out of the vehicle. And then that's the team effort. They get out, you know, they do whatever they got to take care of. They do a cleansing debrief. And then we're going to, and then they move on. And that's
And here's my word of advice. If you're listening to this and you're going, I'm not sure I need it today, you know, and this is the deal. When you do a clean debrief or when you do that thing, you're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it for the weakest guy or girl on the team. The one who has shit going on and doesn't want to share it because they don't feel, you know, they don't feel they want to burden you guys with it. And they're not completely in balance. They're not going to say, I need this. So it's needed for everybody to do it to help the ones that can't reach out for help because they just can't at that moment. And the same thing goes for clean debris.
So even if someone says that they don't need it, you know what? You also don't need to change your underwear. I kind of feel like, you know, it's hygiene. Fucking do it. Just do it. Get into the ritual of doing it. Brushing our teeth. Like, there are certain things that we need to do in our life so that we stay healthy. I mean, just get into the habit. How long is it until something becomes a habit? I don't know.
Until it does. So that's a great thing. Also, I'm thinking about barriers. I'm thinking about things people are going to say in a firehouse. And one of the things is, you know, there's four people on an engine crew in Virginia. So three of them do it. And the one guy rolls his eyes and is like, gets in the rig and doesn't do anything. So afterwards, someone can go, hey, this isn't for you. This is for me. This is for the weakest link on the team. You're the strongest link.
The most stigmatized person who doesn't dare ask for help.
Yeah. I need you to do this for your brothers and sisters, not for yourself. And they'll benefit for themselves. And I'm just thinking about barriers and what officers can do.
That's a huge barrier.
And what leaders can do, you know, even informal leaders, the driver who's been there for 25 years and everyone looks up to him.
Yeah. Definitely.
It's the group. It's the family unit. Absolutely. I think that's a really good point.
Yeah. I like that. It's not for you. It's for everybody else.
Yeah. Very cool.
Because we're givers.
And the same thing goes, you know, for if you're going to be the tough one going, I don't need that. I got control. I got my nerves under control. I got my shit together. Yeah. Then you're sending a signal to everybody else that, you know, hide your weaknesses until you break. And that's a really stupid thing to do.
I'm not helping you. I'm not interested. Because Craig and I were talking earlier, and I've got this new thing that my obsession is with peer support and how important peer support is. But then I watch the men and women that are taking care of everybody at their own expense and busting their asses and being exhausted at all hours of the night with peer support. And I was thinking, why is it not peer support should be, if people learn these basic skills is what Craig called it, which was, why are we not teaching skills to all of our first responders? Since if your job is to help others, it also means helping others in your family and your firefighter family. Therefore, like that whole belief needs to change. It needs to be a culture, you know, wellness culture. But Craig was like, you know, yeah, it should be maybe basic skills.
The basic like that, training.
Basic every, training. Like
every emergency responder knows peer support. Every firefighter knows how to throw a ladder and peer support. Every cop knows how to draw a gun and handcuff somebody. It's like basic material. Like every Marine's a grunt. Every emergency responder should be a peer support personnel.
Which also will help them serve the public.
Yeah, absolutely. And help them support their families and help their families support them. Because if you come back from work and you've been doing some really grim stuff during the day and you want to protect your family or they don't want to hear it or you don't want to bring it to the dinner table, you might tell them later and then you forget. So in either case, if your family knows that they can tell you, you know what? You look like shit. Can I do some tapping for you? Sure. It's 5 minutes. And it's a neurobiological treatment that actually gets you out of whatever, and you don't need to talk about it, but at least your family is getting closer together, and a kid can do it for a parent. Imagine the pride of a kid, you know, I helped my dad. He's a law enforcement officer, and he came home, he looked like shit, I helped him. That is the pride of his life. So you're changing the dirty stuff you're carrying back behind your back and hoping nobody sees. You're changing that into something positive that brings the family together, still without talking about it, because you don't have to.
Yeah, you don't have to.
And that's all the time we have, so that's it for Mindful Decontamination for First Responders this week. We learned about the blowout technique, which is phenomenal and very impactful. Tune in next week, and we will give you tapping. We will learn the technique that Ulf was just talking about, and we can help ourselves and help our families for a better tomorrow. Thank you.